As we saw in the introductory talk, the medieval vision of the world, the model that modern man has discarded, was one of harmony and order. But even more importantly, all of this order, this eager turning of the wheels of the heavens, was put into motion through a sense of desire, in a kind of response to the vision of the eternal. But what was this eternal? What was the living point that stood at the center of the universe? It was timeless, spaceless, unable to be smelled or heard or even seen. But this did not prevent the medieval imagination from trying to think about it, talk about it, hint at it. And this makes up one of the chief characteristics which Lewis admired so much in the medieval thinkers, their attempt to use the imagination to create a positive image of ultimate reality. Here again for Lewis, modern man had been left at a disadvantage, because he had been left with only a vague, empty image of heaven or eternity, which drew from him no positive feeling of goodness. As Lewis put it in an essay called Transposition, quote, "Our notion of heaven involves perpetual negations. No food, no drink, no sex, no movement, no mirth, no events, no time, no art." Good Christians do, of course, believe that the vision of God will outweigh all of these earthly affections. But Lewis worried that our present notion of the beatific vision cannot outweigh our present notion of the earthly goods we love. Quote, "Thus the negatives have, so to speak, an unfair advantage in every competition with the positive. What is worse, their presence, and most when we most resolutely try to suppress or ignore them, vitiates even such a faint and ghost-like notion of the positive as we might have had. The exclusion of the lower goods begins to seem the essential characteristic of the higher good. We feel, if we do not say, that the vision of God will come not to fulfill, but to destroy our nature. This bleak fantasy often underlies our very use of such words as holy or pure or spiritual." End quote. In other words, your vision of heaven is most likely watery, sallow, remote, shadowy, and faint. It doesn't have any weight. And thus, we often don't feel a positive attraction to goodness, because our conception of ultimate goodness lacks density or gravity. In contrast, the medieval imagination constantly took recourse to positive images. Although medieval writers were as aware of the limitations of these images as we are, that is, they did not believe their metaphors were speaking any literal reality about the cosmos, they were nevertheless willing to devote significant effort in trying to use positive figures for this realm of bliss. For instance, in his scholarly book, Allegory of Love, Lewis praised the description of the garden in the medieval poem, The Romance of the Rose. Quote, "This passage represents Jean's highest reach as a poet. No one who remembers the fatuity of most poetical attempts to describe heaven, the dull catalogues of jewelry and mass singing, will underrate this green park, its endless sunshine and fresh grass and grazing flocks," end quote. These very words of praise for this medieval author in mind can be heard as an echo in Lewis's own description of his own vocation as a writer. He says in a short piece called Sometimes Fairy Stories May Say Best What's to Be Said, that at first his mind just had a couple of images sort of bubbling up in them, like a fawn with a package and a queen on a sledge, isolated. But he discovered that these images could best unfold within the form of a fairy story. It was only later that he realized how valuable such a form could be. Quote, "I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings, and reverence itself did harm. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency." End quote. In other words, Lewis's own background in the literature of the pre-modern medieval world is related to his talent in rendering such moving imaginative pictures. But it really was Dante who taught him more about how to overcome our lack of desire and cast a good spell than anyone else. Indeed, I would venture to say that Lewis loved no author more than Dante. His admiration of Wordsworth, for example, was great, but he outgrew his unqualified love for him. This was not so with Dante. His admiration for the medieval poet only increased. And so, just as when Augustine wanted to talk about love or loss and would reach deep into his mind to try to find language adequate to capture the power of that experience, and then would inadvertently begin quoting passages from Virgil, Lewis would open his mouth to say something moving and personal and find himself quoting Dante. For instance, he refers to Dante nearly 70 times in his three most important scholarly books, Allegory of Love, Discarded Image, and English Literature in the 16th Century. And it, as if his mind were constantly drifting back to the Italian poet for illustrations. In his apologetic works, like Problem of Pain, he cites Dante's description of the God of Love as an example of the numinous. In his letters, Lewis first mentions reading Dante in 1917, when he took a 7-week crash course in Italian from Mr. Kirkpatrick. He reports proudly to his father in a letter, "On Sunday, I read the first 200 lines of Dante with much success," end quote. He first read Paradiso when he was in the hospital, recovering from wounds he received in World War I. A couple of years later, he spent a happy vacation with his friend Owen Barfield, going for walks and reading passages from Dante's Paradiso in the afternoon. And later, he described to his friend Arthur Greaves what that reading experience was like. Quote, "Paradiso has really opened a new world to me. It certainly seemed to me that I had never seen at all what Dante was like before. Unfortunately, the impression is one so unlike anything else that I can hardly, describe it for your benefit. A sort of mixture of intense, even crabbed language, complexity of language and thought with what seems impossible, at the very same time a feeling of spacious gliding movement, like a slow dance or like flying. It's like the stars, endless mathematical subtlety, yet at the same time the freedom and liquidity of empty space. I should describe it as a feeling more important than any poetry I have ever read." In 1931, Lewis read Dante every Thursday night with a fellow Oxford don. Later, Lewis became friends with Dorothy Sayers, and he critiqued her translations of the comedy as she produced them, one canticle at a time. We'll see later how much Lewis borrowed from Dante for The Great Divorce, but he also admitted to a scholar that his Green Lady, in Perelandra, was modeled on Dante's Matilda. As we have also seen, Lewis's mind returned to Dante in times of grief, when trying to console a friend, reminding him of how Beatrice turned her eyes away from Dante to the eternal fountain. There doesn't seem to be a moment in Lewis's life in which Dante was not close at hand and vividly present in his thoughts. What was it then that so compelled such strong affection in Lewis? The first part of Lewis's answer is humorous. In part, the medieval poet was simply the beneficiary of his age. Through no merit of his own, Dante simply lived in an inherently more poetic cosmos. And thus, when he simply described his world with accuracy, he produced, almost accidentally, some great poetry, like a crystal held up to light. Many of these instances where Dante seems very poetical in our eyes, advancing daring metaphors Lewis contests, are not actually very inventive at all. Dante was only giving voice to medieval science. Quote, "I think Dante's poetry, on the whole, the greatest of all the poetry I've ever read. Yet, when it's at its highest pitch of excellence, I hardly feel that Dante has very much to do. There's a curious feeling that the great poem is writing itself, or at most, that in the tiny figure of the poet is merely giving the gentlest guiding touch here and there to energies which, for the most part, spontaneously group themselves and perform the delicate evolutions which make up the comedy." End quote. In other words, in Dante's cosmos, there's less of a gap between metaphor and reality. This, the scholar tells us, is the baffling paradox of Dante's poetry. Its greatness is, paradoxically, marked by an ease, as if the poetry could write itself, like someone who just nudges a ball and it rolls down a hill. This is the first reason Lewis found Dante's poetry so enchanting, but the second reason takes us back to the idea of transposition. You'll remember that in that essay, Lewis described the dynamic of a higher language expressing itself within a lower language, like a symphony transposed for a piano. Dante's poetry, then, is a restless struggle to find sensible imagery for that invisible, placeless, timeless eternity. Or as Lewis puts it about Dante's mind, it's, quote, curiousness, the almost sensuous intensity about things not sensuous, end quote. Other poems, when they begin to describe the highest reaches of heaven, begin to become attenuated. Remember Lewis's comment about dull catalogs of jewelry and mass singing. But Dante gets more concrete, more sensible, the closer his pilgrim gets to God. Even while trying to treat the most abstract realities, we have images of, quote, Dante in the garden and Dante in the streets, his feeling for the silent, growing life and his cheerful, spontaneous interest in the state and courtesies, the trades and skills of men. It is perhaps this continual reference both to the quiet, moistened earth and to the resonant pavements, workshops, and floors which support and make convincing his invention of a heaven which, in the obvious sense, makes very few concessions to the natural man, end quote. Indeed, Lewis was so interested in the particulars of how Dante built this atmosphere into his poetry that he conducted a study of Paradiso, in which he counted up all the metaphors and all the similes in the last 11 canti of Paradiso. Having made a catalog of all of its imagery, he divided it up into different categories, and the results of the list are more fascinating than you would think. According to Lewis's reckoning, there are three images of smell, two images of the seal, two metaphors borrowed from the life of the student, four images that use the metaphor of sleep or waking to describe how Dante reacted to some heavenly phenomenon. Then there are five images of children, mainly of infants, nursing. When we remember that Dante was a love poet, it comes as a surprise that there are only seven metaphors that refer to marriage or erotic love. On the other hand, it is surprising that there are seven images of weighing or weight. As Lewis puts it, I have always felt that no poetry, least of all any whose theme is so unearthly as Dante's, has such an admirable solidity, end quote. This class is particularly exemplary because Lewis's favorite Dantean image belongs to it. When Dante's being examined by St. James on the virtue of hope, there's a moment where the pilgrim, like a student taking a very difficult oral exam, looks up in search of comfort and encouragement from his professors. And when the pilgrim looks up, the poet describes his experience like looking up at mountains. But he doesn't just see them towering, but he rather feels their weight as if they were pressing down on him. It was from this canto of Dante, it seems, that Lewis borrowed his metaphor of the weight of glory. Looking up at the saintly figures, Dante feels their ponderous holiness as massive mountains. Thus, heaven's glory has all the density and crushing weight pushing in and down on you as if you were at the bottom of an ocean, all the solidity of stone and carried rock. When you think about all the pale and sickly metaphors Dante could have used, you recognize to what extent his holy restlessness was adverse to using stale language for religious experience. As Lewis put it, no direct praise of their wisdom or sanctity could have made us respect them half so much. Or take another example. Everyone knows how the Christian is called by Paul a new creation. But in Dante's poetry, that tired metaphor is literalized, if I may. The saints in heaven are described as shining brighter than stars, moving swifter than lightning, producing a more lovely harmony than the planets, glowing like an unending sunrise, smiling more radiantly than the sun, rushing swifter than cold mountain winds. Each and every saint outdoes, as it were, the entirety of the old celestial order. A saintly soul is a new creation. The recreation of a human being is as dramatic an event as God's creation of the first cosmos. Thus, the great part of Dante is that he revitalizes the metaphor that was dead before him. Indeed, Lewis praised those poets who, quote, have at once the tenderest care for old words and the surest instinct for the creation of new metaphors, end quote. In other words, poets who can gather up cliches, hackneyed expressions, and dead metaphors, polish them until they are new. This praise of poets casts light on Lewis's own careful attentiveness to language. He was constantly writing about metaphor and devoted a whole scholarly book, Studies in Words, to tracing meanings of old words, their changes, their range of meaning, and what we can discover if we trace their meanings all the way back to their roots. In this way, Lewis was like a gardener of language, loving the old words and their lives in history. And analogously, C.S. Lewis, again and again, in his sermons, begins with some biblical imagery, which we modern Christians are confused or embarrassed by. Who wants to emit glory in heaven, like shining like a light bulb? Lewis asks in Weight of Glory. And do you really feel the Christian should desire to be famous? In transposition, the liturgical text for the day was on the descent of the Holy Spirit and the gift of speaking in tongues, which Lewis, again, feels initially embarrassed by. But here we see his Dantean vocation at work. Lewis sticks with the old language, the old metaphors, and tends to them with care and love until they're new. You can hear the autobiographical elements in his treatment of the talking horse Brie, for example, who, like a modern, was much too enlightened to believe in the old myths of Aslan as a real lion. Surely that was just figurative. But in Lewis's story, Brie is unexpectedly brushed by Aslan's whiskers and is terrified by the breath and flesh and palpableness of the one who unexpectedly had come to stand in front of him. But back to Dante. In the comedy, there are astronomical and military references, as well as 9 images of clothing, and not just the white robes and golden crowns you might expect. Rather, we hear of how joy wraps Adam up like a blanket, or how the river of light is veiled and swaddled in refulgence. Quote, Dante's mind is apparently very sensitive to the experience of putting on and being enfolded, swathed, enveloped. There are also 9 metaphors that refer to tying up or binding with rope. There are images of smiling, laughter, wounds, and even references to how love bites with many teeth. Lewis goes on to say that there are 12 metaphors for opening and closing of things, 16 zoological metaphors, especially birds, 24 for weather, such as dawn and dew, sunrises and plentiful rain. There are 24 more metaphors for civic functions, such as likening the saints to barons or the communion of saints to a city. 25 images of light and heat, 25 images of plants and vegetation. Quote, the poetry of Paradiso is as full of roots and leaves and growth as it is of lights, end quote. And finally, the image that occurs more than any other. Can you guess it? Those which pertain to the trades and crafts. Quote, the arts, crafts, manufacturers, and skilled occupations of men. From painting, musical instruments, seals and sealing wax, clocks, thread, money in a purse, hammer and anvil, rowing, riddling with a sieve, archery at the butts, the cares of the artist, the jeweler, the geometrician, and the astronomer observing an eclipse. And finally, on the very eve of the ineffable vision, a good prudent reminder that a good tailor cuts his coat according to his cloth. End quote. In light of Lewis's list of Dante's images, we can begin to see Dante through Lewis's eyes. That is, why reading the Paradiso felt to the youthful Lewis like joining in some spacious, gliding movement, like a slow dance or like flying. It was so ethereal, and at the same time, it's so tactile and tangible and sensuous. Dante's language constantly evokes ordinary terrestrial events, daily crafts, and diurnal events, such as growth and eating and clothing, which we love and know. Dante uses the concrete and humble things for that distant country of heaven. In other words, Lewis loved Dante because he made his heaven envelop, penetrate, invade, burn, and restlessly seek to come within. Let me conclude my remarks on Dante with reference to one particular scene. one in which the poet stacks up image upon image, creating a turning, twisting, kaleidoscopic poetry that gives a dizzy sense of exhilaration. The passage comes at the end of Paradiso 30 and at the beginning of Paradiso 31. There, the pilgrim sees the whole community of saints, for the first time, gathered in one great assembly. And as the pilgrim looks, the poet desperately seeks for a likeness, a metaphor, that does justice to the spiritual radioactivity of their glory. And so Dante at first describes them as collections of flowers in a meadow. But then he switches the image to that of a single rose. Dante drops that metaphor and likens the saints to a city. And then he says they were marching in rank and file like soldiers in an army, before likening the saints again to so many petals on a white rose. Soon we hear of a river that shoots sparks forth, and those sparks leap out and fall on flowers which are likened to rubies inscribed in gold. The living sparks, as though inebriated by the odors of the flowers, then plunge back into the river. Dante later likens this whole vision to a hill reflected in a body of water at its base, as if it were studying itself in a mirror. The reality to which Dante gestures is ineffable. It eludes words, and thus this intensely shifting and undulating imagery is appropriate. And the shifting use of metaphor gives his poetry a dreamlike intensity, as if the poet were looking through a kaleidoscope. And yet, Beatrice says, quote, "The river, the topazes, the laughter of the meadows are shadowy prefaces of their truth," end quote. Thus, the language we have is vibrantly alive, as if a higher mode of being were erupting in a lower language, as if under high pressure, the lower language were melting down. Do you remember what Eliot said? "Words strain, crack, and sometimes break. Under the burden, under the tension, slip, slide, perish, decay, with imprecision, will not stay put." This is surely what Lewis meant by Dante's intensity of thought. Dante's vision of goodness is not stale or vague, but intense. It is enchanting. It is this special sensuousness which the medieval period gave to Lewis, from which he learned how to create his own writing. Lewis felt that fantasy provided him with the medium he needed to help reverse the coldness of his own childhood toward religion. For instance, following his medieval exemplars, Lewis adopted imaginative fiction for its flexibility and plasticity for his Great Divorce, a work of heavily indebted to Dante. Lewis begins that story with the confused narration told in the first person, told about a man, we later realize it's Lewis himself, walking around an eerily discourteous and empty city in an evening that never turns to night. In Great Divorce, Lewis and the other passengers get on a magical bus and take a flight. When they arrive in heaven as curious tourists, the passengers are allowed to walk around and explore, as well as hold conversations with loved ones from Earth. But in almost every case, the souls are put off by heaven because they have stepped into a world that's so real and so intense that it's painful to them. The remainder of the story is about the interior moral struggle in which these infernal souls try to invent excuses for why heaven is just not for them. Meanwhile, the saints in heaven, assigned to speak to them, try to use every trick to appeal to their freedom, to get them to surrender, to confess, and to stay. Lewis could not have crafted this world without being a student of the medieval world, but of Dante in particular. The first-person narration of a vision is a modern transposition of Dante's first-person visit to the afterlife. His angelic driver of the bus is dismissive and disdainful, just as the angelic messenger is in Inferno 9, as Lewis himself admitted. Throughout Great Divorce, there are vague prophecies about future darkness, which is directly parallel to the souls in hell telling Dante that a day will come in which they will no longer be able to see anything but darkness. Lewis's interaction with his teacher, George MacDonald, is analogous to the instruction that Dante gets from Virgil and other guides. But the scene in which MacDonald tells Lewis to, quote, "tell the truth plainly," particularly resembles the frank advice that Dante's great-great-great-grandfather, Cacciaguida, gives him in Paradiso. But most importantly, though, is Lewis's desire to try to get that weighty, quality of goodness, that substantial heaviness of heavenly realities, often through using humble images of the everyday. For example, Lewis turned Dante on his head by borrowing from Purgatorio to depict the saintliness of the ordinary housewife, Sarah Smith. Lewis has her make a grand entry and a procession with angels and animals, modeled on Dante's own description of the procession of Beatrice. But Lewis's most ingenious stroke comes at the end. Throughout the story, the narrator had insinuated doubts about the goodness of heaven. Doesn't heaven feel just a bit snobbish? After all, if the saints are so loving, why wouldn't they be willing to leave their home and come down to hell? But the truth is, they can't. Lewis's character at one point begins to express a rather natural sentiment. If the people of heaven are so loving, then why don't they go down into hell, invade hell, for example, and show their mercy down there? He says, quote, "But she didn't go down with him to hell. She didn't even see him off by the bus." My teacher gave a curious smile. "Look," he said. And with the words, he went down on his hands and knees. I did the same. And presently I saw that he plucked a blade of grass. Using its thin end as a pointer, he'd made me see, after I had looked very closely, a crack in the soil, so small that I could not have identified it without his aid. "I cannot be certain," he said, "that this is the crack ye came up through, but through a crack no bigger than that ye certainly came." But, I gasped with a feeling of bewilderment, not unlike terror. "I saw an infinite abyss, and cliffs towering up and up, and then this country on top of the cliffs." "Aye, but the voyage was not made by mere locomotion. That bus and all ye inside it were increasing in size." "Do you mean that hell, all that infinite empty town, is down in some little crack like this?" "Yes, all hell is smaller than one pebble of your earthly world, but it's smaller than one atom of the world, of this world, the real world." "It seems big enough when you're in it, sir." "And yet all loneliness, angers, hatreds, envies, and itchings that it contains, if rolled into one single experience and put into the scales against the least moment of the joy that is felt by the least in heaven, would have no weight that could be registered at all." In this revelatory moment, then, Lewis found an imaginative vehicle, a modern fantasy story or fairy tale, in order to make a metaphysical and medieval point. In medieval thought, pure evil is the same as nothingness. It's like absolute zero on the Kelvin scale. Ultimate happiness is, if I can put it this way, ontological fullness, pure concentrated joy that makes evil deeds, which seem so threatening and enticing, seem pathetic and almost non-existent in their happiness quotient by comparison. But even if we think that God is the source of ultimate happiness and contentment, we don't see it. But Lewis came up with a striking reversal of our expectations through the vehicle of a myth in order to make us feel, even if just for a moment, the weight and heaviness of ultimate reality.